Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Rodriguez and others against Compass Shipping Company. You may proceed whenever you're ready.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, this is an appeal brought as a result of a conflict in the interpretation of part of a federal statute. The conflict arises in the application of Section 933B of an act known as the Longshoremen and Harbor Workers Act. This act was last amended by Congress in 1972, at which time Section 933B was not amended. Section 933B was last amended in 1959, at which time it was amended to give the longshoremen an additional 6 months period to sue from the date of a formal award in compensation.
Mr. Lassoff, might I interrupt you preliminarily there? I noticed that there are three cases consolidated here, and that in the Rodriguez case, as opposed to the other two, there was an order filed, and in the other two there were not. Does that have any bearing on the outcome in your view?
It does, but this was not one of the points I was given certiorari on. It is our view in all three of these cases there was never an order which triggered this mechanism. But that was not one of the points that we were given certiorari on. The American Association of Trial Lawyers have raised that in their brief, but we didn't raise it in our brief for today.
It's not before.
The point involved is who was this statute designed to protect? Going back to the original basis in law, at one point a longshoreman had to elect before the first payment of compensation whether or not he could sue a third party, because if he accepted one payment of compensation, his rights to sue were assigned absolutely to his employer. That changed until he was given the right to accept compensation short of an award. In other words, if there was voluntary payment of compensation for a man who was out for 6 months, and the employer voluntarily paid that money, that would not give the case to his employer. But if there was a hearing at which permanency was decided, and an order was entered, that order gave the case to the man's employer. In 1957, I believe, this court decided a Blasey-Soplocki case, which said that conflict of interest, and Blasey-Soplocki was a very strong conflict of interest case. The insurance carrier represented both parties to the litigation. Therefore, in 1959, Congress amended this act and said, you can keep your case, Mr. Longshoreman, until such a point as 6 months after a formal award, because we have several interests here. All of this is based on a quid pro quo between the longshoreman and the employer. Nowhere is the shipping company or the shipping corporations mentioned. They do not belong in this statute, and they have never been mentioned until 1972, when an additional part of the statute was added called Section 905B. What was the intent? All right. After the enactment of this act, by judicial law, certain things apply. Prior, there was a Seraki case. The court gave longshoremen the right to sue vessels for a violation of the doctrine of seaworthiness. Subsequent, the Ryan case gave the ship companies the right to sue the employer on a contract basis, for actual or implied warranties of workmanlike performance. So the issue was sort of dead because any employer of maritime labor obviously had a conflict of interest between the employee and the fact that they would immediately be brought into the action by the ship owner. Notwithstanding that, there were several cases in that period. The Potomac Electric Power Company case and McClendon against Charante, which interpreted the meaning of Section 933B. Both of these cases say, and certainly PEPCO in clear language, say that any time there is a failure by the employer or the person subrogated to the employee's rights to sue, then that case should go back to the employee, and that it is not up to the employee to prove a conflict of interest with his employer. In 1972, as stated, there was sort of a political arrangement made between the stevedoring companies and the labor suppliers. The political arrangement was that in exchange for a substantial increase in benefits, the longshoremen would have certain judicially created rights taken away from them. They would have the right of the doctrine of seaworthiness taken away from them. The ship owner, in exchange for that benefit, would have taken away from it the judicially created application of Ryan.
Well, this political compromise that you referred to that took place in 1972 had the full participation of the Longshoremen Workers Union, did it not?
It had participation of the maritime unions, non-sea unions, and of the stevedores. The shipping companies had no part in this arrangement at all. It was strictly the longshoremen, the ship repairers, the stevedoring companies. This was not really a bill that was participated in or abetted by shipping interests. This was strictly stevedoring interests. And I'm not sure that the longshore unions were aware of what was happening, because in 1972 there was no application of a six-month assignment, because quite clearly Congress, being in this circuit, and PEPCO, which is a D.C. case, and District of Columbia workers, which are governed by this very act, since the act is silent about the intent of this section, it must be assumed that Congress believed the law to be as it was in Potomac Electric Power, and that is, there was no assignment, or if there was, it would revest, if for any reason the right to bring this action was not undertaken properly. In Soplaki, the court talks about a trustee situation which they didn't feel necessary. Mr. Justice Frankfurter did think it necessary, but it wasn't done. We have certain equitable proceedings here. The only interest that the ship owner has in this litigation at all is that he be sued by the real party in interest, one lawsuit. There has not been more than one lawsuit brought since 1972, since the decisions in Rodriguez, since the decisions in Caldwell against Ogden Steamship Company, since the Bandy cases, no stevedoring company has brought a lawsuit to enforce its statutory lien. We have been successful under the decision in Rodriguez, which indicated that ratification was a measure where companies were willing to cooperate to get certain insurance companies, not stevedoring companies, but insurance companies of stevedores, to ratify the longshoreman's cause of action. The one time we tried the suggestion in Caldwell, which was involuntary joinder, that was against a company called International Terminal Operating Company, their attorneys opposed the involuntary joiner and it was denied. But the fact is that no stevedoring company that I know of anywhere has ever sued a ship to assert the claims of the injured employee. And the decision that a longshoreman can prove a conflict of interest, which is so apparent on the face, never happened, without means of extra protection, it doesn't make sense to me, Your Honor.
Well, it could be that, logically it could be that the injured longshoreman has always sued.
Not quite, Your Honor, as you can
well,
see. This appeal.
I know. Logically it could be, but here's one case where it didn't happen.
There are at least 10 cases here, Your Honor. There are 5 in Virginia and 3 and 5 here, all in this
but
one
I
appeal.
I would suppose the vast majority of cases a longshoreman himself would sue.
Yes. But there are hundreds of cases affected by this particular. There are hundreds of cases in the district court now which are on a so-called suspense calendar because of this particular case.
Why, as a matter of practical fact, doesn't the longshoreman sue in the 6 months period given to him?
Ordinarily, he does. There are problems when you are dealing with foreign flag steamship companies, as 92% of the ships coming to the United States are. They are difficulty in locating the company. We can start an action by mail, but if we do not perfect service, the courts dismiss these actions. So that to say that it is easy to start these actions within 6 months of an award is usually so, but not always so.
Congress could, or I'll put it this way, could Congress correct that and make some other form of service possible so that it would eliminate the problem?
Congress could do many things. Congress could compel the ship owners to post a bond of insurance on their coming here.
An agent for service.
Yes, or an agent for service. None of these things have been done.
Or could enlarge the time beyond 6 months. Make it a year, 18 months, 2 years.
The question is not a period of time. The question is, what is the intent of Congress?
Well,
Every bill says safety, this is a hazardous occupation, 8 times the national rate, 4 times the national rate. Every bill says that. How is it protecting the rights of these longshoremen by saying that if the employer does not sue, a party not intended to be benefit, the negligent tortfeasor has an absolute indemnity from suit, the stevedoring company is wasting its assets, which are intended to be used for the protection of longshoremen, and
The stevedoring company's assets are intended to be used for the benefit of longshoremen. I would have thought if it were a corporation, its assets were probably to be used for the benefit of its stockholders.
That is true. But the statute says that since this is such a hazardous occupation, the only way we know of is to make the employer responsible. We want these benefits to be substantially increased, and we don't want the employer to waste its benefits by not collecting them. That is what would happen here. If the employer does not sue because of a business reason, and as I said, they've never sued, they are wasting assets that probably belong to the longshoreman, who has an 80% interest in the remainder of the case.
And who has 6 months in which to assert it?
He has 6 months in which to assert it. But the question is, equitably, equitably, does the purpose of the statute, is it perfected by giving a negligent tortfeasor a right that it was never intended to have?
Well, what do you say to us, to the any statute of limitations argument in a situation like this? There must come a period of repose where past things that have not been litigated can no longer be litigated.
I have no objection to a statute of limitations. There is a statute of limitations. This is not the statute of limitations.
But it's the same type of principle.
It isn't, because every lawyer practicing in this field knew of the various statutes of limitations. As Your Honor pointed out to me yourself, nobody knew that this act could be triggered by an informal agreement of a claims examiner when the statute specifically said that it had to be the deputy commissioner or the board. This is the problem. We are making a statute of limitations out of an assignment. The assignment wasn't intended to hurt the employee. It was intended, according to law, to give the cause of action to the employer who had better assets to pursue it. I don't believe that, but that was what Congress specifically stated. Now, what is the actual fact? The actual fact is that employers may not choose to do this, one, for fear of antagonizing their customers, bad business, or two, their lawyers do not work the way plaintiffs' lawyers do on a contingency basis. They would expect to be paid whether they won or lost. And I say to you that the best person to have these rights is the plaintiff's lawyer, the plaintiff, the injured worker. If he has a right, let him have the right that he always had, the statute of limitations. If an employer refuses to sue, and we can give the employer the right to sue, we can send him a registered letter. If you don't sue, we're going to sue. That protects the employer, does it not? But why should this injured man, who gets nothing for pain and suffering, who gets nothing except two-thirds of his pay, and unless it's permanent, that two-thirds does not go up if the union pay scale goes up. In other words, the best that a longshoreman can get here is two-thirds of his pay at the time of the accident, regardless of whether the pay scale goes up. Nothing for pain and suffering. And while you will hear argument that the pay scale went up a great deal, in certain instances it went down a great deal. I will save that for rebuttal, if I may. Thank you.
Your Honor,
Mr. Stearns.
If it may please the Court, my name is Stearns. I represent the first two respondents, being Compass Shipping Company, Jakarta Lloyd, and Area National Shipping Line in this case, which involves question of Section 33 and also Section 5B of the Longshoremen and Harbor Workers' Compensation Act. There's been a brief reference to some part of the history of the Act. As I understand it, the Longshoremen and Harbor Workers' Compensation Act was adopted in 1927 in response to a decision of this Court making Longshoremen Jones Act seamen. At that time, there was a Section 33. It provided that longshoremen have an election of either compensation or a suit for damages. In response, apparently, to the concern for the possibility that someone would unwittingly lose his right to a third-party damage suit, Congress in 1938 amended Section 33 to expand the rights in a way which this Court in 1947 in the American Stevedore against Perello case held to extend to longshoremen the dual right to accept voluntary compensation and thereafter sue for damages. After Ryan, and perhaps before that, perhaps in the contribution cases, the existence of the right to accept voluntary compensation and sue for damages created a conflict of interest. Unquestionably, there was a conflict of interest which was raised by the Ryan indemnity right, which in instances where there was common insurance between a defendant and a third-party defendant, as in the Siplicki case, it was held by this Court that it was inappropriate to give effect to the Section 33B assignment. In response to that, Congress in 1959, in attempt to overcome the conflict of interest, gave Longshoremen an additional 6 months to sue following receipt of compensation pursuant to an award. As a result of this Court's efforts on behalf of Longshoremen, in part demonstrated by the Perello case, the extension of the dual remedy of compensation and a right to sue for damages, as a result of this Court's Ryan decision, as a result of this Court's Seriaki decision, the situation existed, a situation existed, whereby longshoremen were, of course, by statute, guaranteed compensation, and in effect were guaranteed a virtually certain right to recover damages. As a result of these facts, and as a result directly of this Court's efforts on behalf of longshoremen, there followed an explosion of litigation in the years, according to the congressional documents, between 1961 and 1972, to the point where in ports such as New York, virtually every longshoreman's reported accident resulted in a third-party suit. By virtue of Seriaki, it was virtually necessary only for the longshoreman to show that he was hurt aboard the ship as a result of a contest between the shipowner and the stevedore as to who should pay the damages. The ultimate recovery of the plaintiff was further guaranteed. Congress in 1972 was therefore confronted with a situation where this Court's efforts had resulted in a situation where longshoremen had a free access to suit and a free access to recovery in their third-party cases, where as a result of those facts, there had been a tremendous increase in litigation and took steps by enacting the 1972 amendments in order to reduce the volume of litigation in exchange for vastly increased compensation benefits. As Mr. Lassoff has indicated, Congress in 1972 took away from longshoremen certain things, and this represents the first instance since 1927 where either by this Court or any other Court or by Congress, something was taken away. What was taken away was two things, we submit. The first one, obviously, being the right to recover for seaworthiness. And the second thing, we believe, is that there was an additional restriction placed on the third-party right in order to serve the first purpose of the 1972 amendments, which was to reduce litigation and relieve ship owners and the courts from the enormous burden of case after case after case of personal injuries involving longshoremen, some of which were of the kind or the type or the apparent lack of seriousness of the cases involved in this appeal. The additional step taken by Congress, we submit, was to make the right of the longshoreman to sue depend upon that suit being in accordance with Section 33, which we read as indicating that suit can be maintained only if authorized by the 6 months provision in Section 33B, which means, we submit, that no suit brought by a longshoreman after 6 months can be maintained, since the 6 months provision is a constituent element of his cause of action. In the congressional documents, there is an indication in the Port of Philadelphia that the compensation insurance rate for these accidents, including the cost of compensation and the stevedore's third-party Ryan indemnity liability, was approximately $40 a payroll hundred. According to the New York State Rating Board, in New York today, for workman's compensation alone, in the category stevedoring not otherwise classified, the manual rate for stevedores is $87 and change per payroll 100. That is to say that the cost of the stevedores, both for compensation and third-party Ryan indemnity liability, in 1972 was approximately half what it is today. And these figures are not figures that are the product of inflation. It's $40 per 100 and $87 per 100. And it represents a doubling of cost in real terms as a direct result of the vast increase in benefits achieved by the 1972 amendments. It means, in effect, that the maritime industry, and since the stevedore has one customer, the shipowner, since the stevedore is, in effect, an agency of the shipowner, that the shipowner pays these costs directly, usually as soon as the ship sails, it means the cost of these claims before the first complaint is filed has doubled. It also means that if there is not relief from litigation, that the purposes of the Act to achieve a reduction of litigation will not be achieved, and that in effect there will be no so-called quid pro quo extended to the maritime industry in exchange for a benefit structure which is of unprecedented generosity. It is vital to the interests of the maritime community that there be, in one appropriate form or other, curb on litigation involving cases like these, involving contused abrasions and puncture wounds, resulting in 6 and 7 weeks of alleged period of disability, where compensation benefits of $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, $6,000, and $7,000 are routinely paid based on the earnings and benefit structure existing in 1973, which have been vastly increased. It is essential to the vitality of the maritime industry that cases of these kind, where and whenever appropriate, be handled as compensation matters. As a result of this court's recent decision in Bloomer, a longshoreman who receives, for example, $5,000 in workman's compensation benefits as a result of his third-party suit only when his verdict exceeds $7,500. As a result of this court's recent decision in the Norfolk and Western against the Leipelt case, the compensation liability, or rather the tax liability, of an injured employee must be reduced in calculating his lost wages and lost future wages. As a typical matter, in longshoremen's personal injury cases, the total cause of action that is presented in the guise of a longshoreman suit against the stevedore is the claim of the stevedore to recover its so-called lien. In one case after another,
did you say that again?
That the entire cause of action, which is presented to a jury as a claim by a longshoreman against a shipowner.
Shipowner.
Third party.
You said stevedore.
I'm sorry. Is in effect, that case in that form is in effect a claim by the stevedore to recover its compensation expenses. There's a case in New York, a case in which Judge Meskill and Judge Friendly dissented, Canizzo against Farrell Lines, reported in 579 Fed Second, which is an excellent illustration of the point I'm attempting to make. The case involved a man in his 50s who had sustained a knee injury. As a result of the knee injury, he had had surgery. He had a heart condition, and he was found to be, by a district court judge, permanently disabled. There was a dispute about a reduction in the award to him after the bench trial on the basis of whether or not he was just industrially disabled or whether, in fact, he was totally disabled.
In any event, there was a calculation of damages with this reduction, which the Court of Appeals found to be inappropriate, of damages in range of $110,000. And the case, after a clear clash between Judge Friendly and Judge Meskel with respect to when in what circumstances a shipowner should be liable to a longshoreman, the case was remanded for retrial on damages. The case was settled. It was settled a little bit less than 7 years after the injury, at which point the lien was $63,900. It was settled for $90,000 so-called fresh money in addition to the lien. The stevedore waived its lien, and $90,000 was advanced by the shipowner to be disposed of to settle the case. Makes the gross settlement $153,000. From that $153,000, as a result of Bloomer, the attorney for plaintiff takes, according to what we assume to be, or what I assume to be, a third contingency retainer fee, the sum of $51,000. For a trial and an appeal to the Court of Appeals to assume that $2,000 was consumed in litigation expenses, I think, is reasonable, reducing the recovery to $100,000, from which, of course, must come the $63,900 lien. In round figures, the recovery by the plaintiff is $36,000. But, of course, that's not his recovery, because he's entitled under Section 33 F and G to so-called deficiency compensation. And he goes back on compensation when the net to him is exhausted. If he was receiving workman's compensation at the rate of $9,000 a year, the net of $36,000 would mean that the stevedore's compensation exposure would be suspended for a period of 4 years. It means that the benefit of the third-party suit, where a lawyer got a fee of $51,000, is interest on $36,000, figured on a declining balance at $9,000 a year at bank interest rates, a figure which might be a range of $2,500 or $3,000. That interest is a double recovery, because he's entitled to his damages or his compensation, whichever is larger.
Counsel, I think that all of us here know of negligence cases that are just the same.
Judge,
you wouldn't throw the whole negligence law out, would you?
Judge, it's not a question.
I'm trying to say, what has it got to do with this case?
Well, what I'm trying to show is that
is this lawyer going to get $12,000?
No, sir, he's not. What I'm trying to do for background is to
could that case be brought here?
It can't now. No, it's been settled. It was not. That's great.
So what good is it?
Well, it's good for an illustration of what the value of the third-party case, the longshoreman, is. And in view of the fact that it is the position of the respondents in this case that there is a, as we've said, constitutive element of suit within 6 months, and since that may involve policy decisions as to what...
Under the Jones Act, there was a case where a man fell through a bomb up in Times Square, and they found that the ship was unseaworthy. We didn't throw out the whole unseaworthy statute.
No. That's true. What I was trying to illustrate is some point about the value of the third-party case to longshoremen, and to suggest that the accordance with provision of Section 5 be interpreted literally and be a basis for a bar of longshoreman suit 6 months, after 6 months, from the time that they received their award. And there's an additional point made with respect to the safety of longshoremen, which is not by any means certainly guaranteed or even advanced by the bringing of longshoremen personal injury cases. It is basically our position that this matter of 6 months to sue is not a matter of Rule 17. It's a matter of Section 33 and Section 5B. It's a time bar. It prevents absolutely the bringing of a suit by a longshoreman unless there is compliance with the statute which authorizes his suit.
Mr. Stearns, do you agree with Mr. Lassoff that the Rodriguez case is
precisely on the same footing as the other two for purposes of our decision here?
Judge, it's the Perez case where a formal order is involved. And there were four questions posed in the application for a writ. One of them had to do with whether or not there had been a sufficient procedural step taken by the Office of Workmen's Compensation Programs in order to trigger the Section 33 assignment. Now, that was not that question. The procedural sufficiency question was not the subject of the writ. So it's irrelevant, I think, for this case. Thank you.
Mr. Byrne.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. 25 years ago, I was admitted to the bar of this Court to work on the brief in the Zabicki case. And I find it rather fascinating that I've returned here now, 25 years later, to talk to the Court about the interpretation of Zabicki, which makes me, I think, the historian on this particular argument. And if we could return for the moment to 1956, when the Congress decided to respond to the Ryan decision, and they did so very expeditiously following the decision of this Court in early 1956. There were extensive hearings held. The conflict of interest argument was explored fully. The Zabicki case was discussed. And at that time, while the hearings were going on, it was between the argument and the decision in the Zabicki case. And the attorneys for Mr. Zabicki testified in 1956. And they testified rather optimistically about
the... testified before the congressional committees.
That's correct. In 1956, in May and June. And in June, this Court decided Zabicki. And as I said, they were optimistic about the result, and it was warranted from their point of view. The Court, or the Congress then, responded and began drafting this six-month provision rule from the time of the award. Now, we've talked about 6 months here, but frequently, as in these cases before us, the time runs anywhere from a year and a half to 2 years that the man himself has the right to sue. He has the full opportunity to bring suit any time during that period. And that's the thrust of the Rodriguez case. Now, in those hearings, there was a comment by, I think, the representative of the Association of the Bar, the City of New York, who said that these congressional adjustments were the complete answer to Mr. Justice Black's objections in his dissent in the Ryan case, that the stevedore would, in effect, be suing itself. So this was all hashed over way back when, in 1956. And then we move forward. Mr. Stearns has covered the 72 amendments, but we move forward to a number of the cases that this Court has had. And in two recent decisions of this Court, Edmonds and Bloomer, the Court itself has read this particular section, 933B, in accordance with its plain meaning. That is that the cause of action is assigned after 6 months to the employer. And in the 1972 amendments, when they added Section 905, the Court incorporated Section 933 into that section and said he may sue in accordance with the provisions of 933B. Then we run into a consistent line of cases in recent years by this Court where the Court follows the plain language of the Act. I cite the Caputo case. I cite the Rasmussen case, where they discuss the plain language and legislative history. The examination of the congressional record, the reports of Congress. The Edmonds case also discusses that point. We go on to the Pfeiffer case against Ford, where the point of rest question was considered, and the court said it was inconsistent congressional intent. So all throughout these cases, right down to the Bloomer case and the most recent case on December 15, the Potomac Electric case, where again the court defers to Congress, to the plain language of the Act, to the unambiguous provisions, even where they may reach an anomalous result. And I think that case involved a question of whether schedule awards applied or the man could take his wages. And the court said, we might have done otherwise, perhaps, but Congress has said this, and this is the way we have to rule.
What do you think the result was anomalous?
I think the Court of Appeals said so, and I think perhaps this court and yourself said so, Your Honor. I return again to the Zablicki case, and there the court, in discussing the conflict, said, under the peculiar circumstances, the peculiar facts of this case, we find a conflict. Now, as opposed to that, we have the Caldwell case, which I think misinterprets Zablicki and says on page 1046, the fundamental point in Zablicki is that notwithstanding a statutory assignment of the longshoreman's right of action, the right of action may be revested in the longshoreman when it becomes manifest that the assignee, with knowledge of its exclusive right to control and prosecute the claim, nevertheless declines to do so for any reason, not because of a conflict, but for any reason. And then it goes on to legislate certain procedures that are followed, again, taking over the congressional role here. Now, I think Congress has spoken, and the man has his season in which to sue. Thereafter, Congress freely intended, I think, that the cause of action would then be assigned, and if the assignee didn't do anything about it, that's the end of the case. Two intentions not to sue, one manifested by the man himself and one by the employer. Thank you very much.
Very well, Mr. Byrne. Do you have anything more, Mr. Blazo?
Just a couple of minutes, Mr. Chief Justice.
May I point out to the court that in Edmonds, which is a decision of this court in March of 1979, the court cautioned that this change in the statute was striking a delicate balance between the law as it was, as created by the judiciary and Congress, and as amended by Congress, taking away certain rights. Nowhere in the 1972 bill does it mention the six-month statute as being intended to take anything away from the rights of the longshoremen. And Mr. Justice White, who wrote the opinion, said very clearly that where Congress has been silent in this delicate balance, it is not up to us to act. Congress said not one word in either the Senate or House about this section, and this section was not changed in the 72 amendments. One thing that isn't too vile, but as Mr. Justice Marshall noted, Mr. Stearns likes to roam far afield. I had a recent situation with Mr. Stearns in New York before a federal judge, Judge Pierce, where Mr. Stearns...
I'll stop.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.
We're going to thank them.